Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and with me, as ever, are Caroline White, Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, Features Director. I hope you've all had a wonderful week so far, and if you're listening to this in North America, happy Thanksgiving. I actually got to experience a Thanksgiving a few years ago while in the US, and I've got to say, I am a big fan. Any opportunity to get together, eat and drink way too much, and have a fight with a cousin who gets all their news from Facebook. What is not to love about that? Actually, that I think that's the only time I've ever eaten pumpkin pie. I can't remember if I enjoyed it or not, really.
I think pumpkin pie is good. I don't know why we don't have more pumpkin pie over here. It's delicious. But I love Thanksgiving as well. I once did a proper kind of proper American Thanksgiving in upstate New York. And it was one of those moments that you just remember forever, because it's like a fairy tale. You know, we woke up to super deep snow in this cabin in the middle of the woods and had this kind of huge 30, 40 person dinner, which now in a kind of time of corona with your mean little bubble seems like a million moons away. But it was amazing. And I had oysters Rockefeller for the first time, which I think is another great thing. I don't know, is that a traditional Thanksgiving thing? I don't think it is, but I remember liking them a lot.
I have no idea.
They sound very glamorous.
Yeah, it felt very glamorous. They were in these really like swanky little dishes, and yeah, it felt like kind of going
very
back
Gatsby.
In time a bit, I think. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was amazing, the whole thing. And I even saw before we went into upstate, I even came out of the Natural History Museum and saw the blimps being inflated for the parade. And that's awesome as well. I mean, we don't do anything like that over here, and it's good fun.
What about those, did you have those sweet potatoes with the marshmallows on? I've always been a bit curious and upset by those.
Yeah.
Were they good?
Could never get on board with that. It tasted exactly how I thought, which is like sweet potatoes with marshmallows on the top, which I, you know, the novelty was great, but would I make them again? No, horrible.
I don't think the Pilgrim Fathers were eating sweet potatoes with marshmallows on the top. That might be a recent addition to the Thanksgiving canon. Talk about the Mayflower. I spent a bit of time on Wikipedia this morning researching the Mayflower, which brought the pilgrims across to North America. So the Mayflower was 100 foot overall, so around 30 meters, and it was carrying 135 people when she crossed the Atlantic in 1620. 30 of those were crew, and it took 10 weeks. Oof, that would have been a tough journey. Sadly, we don't have Thanksgiving, of course, over this side of the pond, but excitement is definitely building to Christmas. And in that spirit, we've put together some gift guides for you on the website if you're stuck for an idea, if you're still out there shopping desperately for that loved one, from jackets to watches and even a Tiffany compass for a mere £730. I tell you what, that is a fancy compass. It's all there. We've also put a gift guide together for kids. But before we go on, Charlotte, tell us more about this week's interviewee.
Sure. So I've mentioned him on this podcast a couple of weeks ago, I think. So now you can hear the full interview. So this week we're speaking to Pete Murphy. He's the CEO of a security company called Priavo. And the best way I can summarize him is he's the kind of guy that if you were stranded on a desert island, you would want him to be leading you to safety. He is ex-special forces, and Priavo takes people all over the world, often to very risky places. And he had a lot of great stories, not all of which we can share. Some of them involve Mexican drug cartels and can't be brought to light. But he also had lots of great insight on how you can stay safe during this very weird time and what you need to do to plan an adventure anytime. And he managed to steer the Red Hot Chili Peppers safely through Egypt on their tour. So I figure if he's able to keep them from getting out of trouble, he's a solid guy.
I have a confession to make. I had a pair of Dr. Martin boots when I was younger, and I used Tippex to draw the Red Hot Chili Peppers logo all over them.
I can't imagine you in Doc Martin. That's a strange, strange image. I was a fan as well. I went to two gigs where I had to kind of claw my way to the very front line. And on one of them, they only played one song and then they left. Massively.
That's very rock and roll, though.
I know.
Alrighty, the January issue is on the precipice of going to press. This is a big issue in it with the top 101. It's talking about all the biggest new boats entering that the top 101 list this year. And it's got all the global order book info in it. And I know I've banged on about the global order book before in this podcast over successive weeks, but I was reading the report. So this basically, when we're producing this report we all read it about 25 times because you just cannot get any of this data wrong. It's so crucial. So I was reading it again yesterday, and there was one more detail I'd like to pull out for you all. So the Global Order Book, first of all, counts all boats over 24 meters LOA in build or ordered globally on the 1st of September each year. And as of the 1st of September this year, there were 821 hulls counted in the Global Order Book. So that's great, right? Up on last year's 807. But that's not the whole story. It turns out that 159 of the boats counted this year should have been delivered this summer, but weren't, for obvious reasons. That might be shipyards. There were raw material delays to shipyards, or speculative projects were being built slow to save costs. Sometimes owners demand that their boats kind of roll over to the next year because it looks like they've got a 2021 boat instead of a 2020 boat. It's like cars, basically. You just want the latest possible model for resale value. And so each year, typically around 80 hulls are counted in the Global Order Book that have missed their delivery slots. But the number this year is extraordinary, 159. So 159 of the 821 boats counted in this year's Global Order Book were delayed and should have been delivered by the September the 1st deadline. So it just goes to show you the havoc that COVID has played on the superyacht industry. Right, who caught the Daily Mail coverage of the World Superyacht Awards? So each year, the Daily Mail generously gives lots of coverage to the World Superyacht Awards. And each year, I love it because not only for the fact that it exposes our brand to a bigger audience, but because of the comments, in fact, mainly because of the comments left below the article online. They're a curious breed, the Daily Mail reader. They seem to love the concept of unfettered free markets, but when that results in ostentatious displays of wealth, it triggers the little socialist voice in all of them. And it leads to some really conflicting comments below the fold. And they're always fun to read. So I picked out some of my favorites, or we've picked out some of our favorites, rather. There was the inevitable classic. There's only two good days when you have a boat, the day you buy it and the day you sell it, forgetting, of course, all the wonderful moments in between.
I love if it doesn't fit in my bath, I'm not interested.
I think the opposite is true of me. If it does fit in my bath, I'm not interested. You're
Why pay 120 million quid to be truly at one with the exterior when you can be truly at one with it by going outside? I mean, come on.
That's a good point.
I love this one. This one guy said, personally, I prefer motorhomes to boats, but these are absolutely stunning.
Oh, I love that. That's sweet.
But to which some wag responded, motorhomes typically sink like a stone. If you're on the water, you're better off in a boat.
Oh, great chat.
Can't argue with that logic.
I like the one that was, and it was done in all caps. I love a shouty Daily Mail comment. All caps, complete with white cat. A bit Bond villainy, but you don't actually, how many owners have cats on board? You see little puppies and dogs all the time, but you don't often see a token yacht cat, ship's cat.
Cats are unlucky, I think. Is that right? Cats and bananas.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, cats and bananas. And women.
All the good things in life.
Yeah.
Lastly, I reckon my rubber dinghy is in with a shout, complete with leopard skin car seats, fairy dice, sporty stripe, and somewhere to put your lunchbox. I'd like to see that rubber dinghy. That sounds like a fascinating, superyacht quality rubber dinghy. Charlotte, tell us more about I know you've mentioned the medical piece you're working on in the past, but you've uncovered some more fascinating insights about the world of medicine and the future of it and how it's going to be incorporated into the superyachting industry. So tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, I am rapidly turning into Dr. HJ, but I am finding these conversations I'm having with people absolutely fascinating. Every time I speak to someone new, I discover something else. And it's really exciting. You know, in the future, the equivalent of a hospital room on a yacht, which very, very, very few boats have at the moment, you'll be able to fit all of that kit into a cupboard. So having this much more advanced technology is, you know, really 5 years away, maybe slightly more than that. And the exciting thing is that technology, so things like handheld MRI scanners or handheld ultrasounds, that already exists. That's already on the market now. It's just a question of when it becomes more commonly used and when it gets signed off by certain authorities. I've had a lot of chat with people about virtual reality stuff as well. So in the future, a surgeon will actually be able to sort of overlay his hands through someone's hands on board. They'll both have headsets and they'll be able to do a stitch to show someone on board how to do a stitch or do a procedure bit by bit so that the person actually carrying it out can copy them inch by inch. So it's just amazing stuff. And obviously that kind of thing happening on board is only going to be for really dire emergencies. But what's really exciting for a lot of people, I think, is that a lot of the medical care coming up is going to be preventative. So, for example, if you've had heart difficulties in the past, you feel completely fine, but you're maybe a bit anxious about doing anything too adventurous because you worry about it playing up. At the moment, you're probably just going to stay close to shore or not even go on a yacht at all. Over the next 5 years or so, there are going to be devices that will allow you to sort of check in with yourself every day, measure your levels of things. And at the first sign of things being off, this device will show you. So you'll then have 5 days to get to the best hospital that you can, you know, tell them what's going on, rather than either risk having a heart attack on board, at which point you're really far down the line, or not being able to go on the journey in the first place. So it's hopefully going to expand travel for a whole load of people who, for whatever reason at the moment, wouldn't be able to. But anyway, this is all coming up in the near future. But here's a top tip for now. The guy I spoke to at Medair, one of these big telemedical services, I was asking him sort of what kind of things they see most commonly. And a lot of them are sort of sprains, people falling down super yacht staircases, that sort of things. But one of the things they've seen a really dramatic increase in recently, one is jellyfish stings from having more jellyfish around. And another is really serious infections from sort of tiny cuts from coral and things. So you come off the boat, you have a little scratch from your snorkeling or whatever. 24 hours later, your leg is huge and you're being airlifted off to an emergency unit, and it's a really serious emergency.
I always get really worried about coral scratches. I don't know, I think I saw a documentary about a decade ago where this exactly happened. Someone was scratched by coral and then there was some awful infection, they lost a leg or something. So I am so careful when I'm around coral now.
Yeah, it almost does something like grow inside you. I mean, it's a living organism, so yeah, you think of it as a rock, but it's really not a rock. Quite a scary rock.
More things for me to be terrified, because I normally would come out completely lacerated and not even think about it. But he was basically saying that these infections are getting a lot worse, and there's some speculation that this is because of pollution. So local communities, maybe particularly if you go somewhere more remote, are sort of washing things into the water, maybe horrible things like waste from abattoirs or whatever, and that bacteria then lives on the reef. So when you get a cut, it's the bacteria going into you that causes these horrible infections. But the truth is, no one knows exactly if that's what's causing it or if it's something else. But the solution is really easy. Just make sure that every time you come back on the yacht, you check yourself over. Any tiny cuts, grazes, scrapes, you just wipe it with a bit of antiseptic and some gauze. And in 99% of cases, that will stop any future problems. So well worth doing if you're not doing already. Just have one when you will come back on deck.
I just want to reverse a little bit to your comment about you. So the virtual reality hands hovering over the body on board that you are copying. You said inch by inch. I just want to say inch by inch doesn't sound remotely precise enough. When
well, you can tell they won't be asking me to do any operations on board. And it's quite funny because the tech is amazing and you can hear the captain sounding really quite alarmed and like, we can't do everything. Crew have to wear many hats, you know, and I think they're afraid of performing kind of open heart surgery, but that is absolutely not the case. But what it does mean is that doctors and surgeons working remotely will be able to have a much better view of the situation. They were even talking about using iPad robots in the new, they were saying in the BVIs, there was a small hospital where they don't have a stroke expert, and they were able to beam in a stroke expert using this iPad robot. So the iPad was walking around and inspecting the patient. They're able to look closely all around the body at any areas they want to, rather than relying on sort of quite blurry VSAT connections or photos sent by the crew. But yeah, the one thing that really came out is that however much kit you have on board, it's only going to work if the crew are really, really properly drilled and using it. So you have to make sure that everyone is really well practiced on what they need to do in an emergency, where the kit is. Doesn't matter if they're already trained, if they've trained with a different group of people, they've all got to be up to speed. And that's something that is a bit of a problem at the moment, because people like Medair just can't train people in person at the moment. And they say there's no substitute for that.
Well, it's really interesting, isn't it, to see like the in, we see, again, going back to the Global Order book, we know there's more explorers in build than ever before. So there's more and more owners doing crazy things, going further and further afield and spending more and more time away from major ports. So they're all going to need this kind of next level medical care as people age on their boats, aren't they? So it's a really interesting future.
It's not just aging, though, as well. When I sort of approached this feature, I was thinking of, you know, people who are maybe retiring on board, who are in poorer health. But actually, the thing that's coming up is that the people who are really investing in this stuff are 20-year-olds who want to fling themselves around doing really adventurous diving in the middle of nowhere. It's adrenaline junkies that really need this stuff, and people who, well, I mean, it's useful for everyone. But the other good thing is that, of course, if you have it on board, you can help sort of local communities and places where you go where they might not have any kind of medical kit. And I think that's the really positive thing. You know, yes, you might never need to use it yourself, but you might be able to help other people in the places you go. And I think that's fantastic.
And just remember, when you get back on the boat, just give your leg a wipe to avoid coral growing out of it.
I think I scared a whole new group of people, sharks and coral, and I'm quite scared of squid. So three big things to be scared of.
It's a terrifying world. Caroline, why don't you talk us through the headlines this week?
Sure. So Heesen is collaborating with Luca Dini for the very first time. That's on the third hull of its 55-meter steel class series, Project Gemini. Exterior lines, which are described as muscular, are by Frank Lautman of Amiga Architects. Luca Dini has penned the interior with what is described as a geometric linear design. He's used materials like tay wood, natural stone, leather wall panels, and fabric-lined ceilings. Apparently, it's going to be very zen. And Project Gemini is due for delivery in autumn 2022.
That kind of speaks to that feature that Elaine Bunting wrote for You Charlotte, that kind of zen comfort, maximizing casual comfort on board because people are spending longer on their boats. So that seems bang on trend.
Absolutely. And one of the things that came out of that was if you're spending longer on board, you're probably spending longer inside than you would do if you're going on sort of 2 weeks around the Med. So if you've got a kind of really dark salon that you've never loved, it's going to be much more apparent as you're spending longer on board. So something kind of light and restful that you really want to spend time in is definitely the way that things are moving.
So speaking of light, bright yachts, San Lorenzo has added a new model to its line of semi-displacement yachts. That is the 35.7-metre SD118. Five units have already been sold. Exterior design is by Zukun International Project, and cool features include a forward living area split across two levels with direct access to the owner's cabin. Staying in Italy, Cantieri Delle Marche has announced the sale of its second Flexplorer model, the 40-metre Maverick. Flexplorer 142 comes hot on the heels of the Flexplorer 130 Aurelia, which was the first in the line, and it was launched pretty recently. Maverick will have a robust displacement hull and exterior design by Hydrotech. The interior, meanwhile, has been designed by Francesco Pascalski and Margherita Casprini.
Two really successful Italian yards there. San Lorenzo just seemed to, every time they announce a new model, the next press release says we've sold five of them already. It's incredible. They seem to be on fire. In fact, they came second in this year's kind of league table of top builders in the Global Oil Book. And credit to Cantieri Delle Marche too. They spoke to us in the January issue and said, you know, they responded really quickly to the pandemic and sold a couple of boats sight unseen. So they to owners that they interacted with virtually and on Zoom and did walkthroughs and all that kind of stuff. But no physical visits took place, and they still sold two boats. So good on them.
Absolutely.
And on the data front, talking about data, it's been data heavy this week. I'm sorry, everybody, if you're not a big data fan, but we can't get enough of it over at Boat International. Caroline, what's the highlight this week?
Well, with the recent order of the first Vanquish 115, it seemed a good opportunity to discuss a category which is less under the spotlight these days, but which still maintains a pretty high level of production, and that is the 24-meter plus sport yacht. By that, I mean a fast open boat. So looking back at the late 70s and 80s, we had the launch of a few legendary sport yachts in this size bracket, including the Picciotti N2, designed by Don Sheed, and the Vosper Gentry Eagle. But we're really talking about one or two boats a year in that size category. Those numbers crept up in the 90s when the first Mangusta 80 and 90 were launched, and from there the market just seemed to explode. There was the Riva 84 Cantata, the Pershing 88, the Magnum 80, the Sunseeker Predator 95, and many more. In the 2000s, we saw entries from Leopard, Lazara, Canados, Otam, the names go on and on. The peak year was 2006, according to our data, when 78 sport yachts were launched. That is 2,255 metres of boat, so a lot of boat. Then came the financial crash, and anecdotally at least, we were told that it affected this market disproportionately because a lot of the clients in that segment were first-time buyers who'd made their money quickly and bought their yachts on finance. After the crash, either those buyers were not feeling so flush or finance wasn't as freely available as it had been.
If you want to read more about financial crash yachts, there is a great feature, and I'm not just saying that because I wrote it, on the website at the moment about super yachts that sort of never made it. And it was speaking to designers about different boats that weren't just concepts. They were kind of in build, they'd laid the keel, or they were really far along with them, and then they got pulled. And almost for everyone, the reason was financial crash of 2008. There were some amazing boats lost then, and it's sad to see what could have been but never materialised because of that year.
That's so sad. Well, luckily, it wasn't the complete end of the road for this particular market. So by 2012, 25 sport yachts of 24 metre plus were launched. And between then and now, the annual tally has hovered modestly but consistently at about 24 and 30. So not too bad. Looking to the future, the 2021 global order book figure is 58. So that's 58 sport yachts of 24 metre plus in build or on order between September 2020 and August 2021. That's about the same as we've had over the last few years, so it's likely to result in the same number of annual launches. About half of those are being built on spec, but I mean, it's not bad, it seems to me, for a segment that's increasingly far removed from the eco-friendly zeitgeist. These are generally fuel-burning, fast yachts. So I think it's a pretty healthy market, personally.
Yeah, it's definitely got that kind of flash association, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Especially those Mangusta just kind of owned this market for the longest time, and Otan built some really cool boats too. Yeah, so if you want to go fast and burn a lot of fuel, perhaps countercurrently, then that's your market. Well, thank you for that, Caroline. Another fascinating insight and a little walk through the headlines and a bit of data. I hope you found that informative and insightful. Right, that's it for us this week. Over to Charlotte, who sat down for an interview with Pete Murphy from security company Priavo.
So the gentleman joining me today is Pete Murphy. He has over 20 years experience working with various international military and civilian agencies, and he's done a number of years within the Special Boat Service and Royal Marines. He's now the CEO of Priavo, a private company that specialises in taking wealthy and vulnerable people to high-risk areas all over the world, including plenty of yacht owners. So he's the man to know if you want to keep you and your family safe. Pete, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. What a shame that we couldn't do this in Monaco, hey?
Well, exactly. I think so. Pete and I had kind of started conversations already because we were due to present this interview as a panel at the Explore Yacht Summit in Monaco, which obviously didn't happen, which was a great shame. But those initial conversations we had did kind of show me that there are plenty of owners out there who still want to take part in big adventures and still are doing that, even at the present moment. Is that what you've seen as well?
Yeah. Yes, particularly during this pandemic, the super yacht industry, I'm sure you're well aware, has been continuing because of the isolated approach to super yachting. I suppose countries where, you know, they're still happy to open their doors. You know, there's measures that need to be put in place to make this a safe environment, but yeah, it's continuing.
And would you say the world at the moment with the kind of pandemic, is it any more risky than it was, you know, 12 months ago? Is it different, or is it essentially, from your perspective, it's the same situations, people going to areas with the same kind of risk and that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's no less risky, but, you know, what we're here to talk about is alleviating risk or managing risk. So it's just another book. I shouldn't say box to tick. It's more than a box ticking exercise, but it's another assessment to involve. Mm-hmm. In your risk assessment. It's another section to evolve in your risk assessment, and there's just more considerations. But along with anything else, you can continue operations as long as you manage the risk correctly.
So the owners that you're working with at the moment, and I don't know how much you can say here without getting into trouble, but people you've been working with this year and people you're working with next year, you know, are they changing their plans a lot? Are they still planning to do exactly what they wanted to do? Are you having to change the way you approach things, or is it kind of business as usual for you guys?
It's been business as usual, and it's been busy.
Good business as usual.
good business as usual, yeah. But I think a lot of owners, management companies were dipping their toes, a little bit unsure to begin with. You know, and also there's country restrictions. So, you know, a lot of planning around crew rotation, security on route to countries. You know, we had to move armories. We had to reposition one of the floating armories to alleviate this. So there's been a lot of juggling, but, you know, it's continuation. Everybody wants continuation. We do, you do, owners do. So, you know, we adapt and overcome based on, you know, based on the assessments made.
So one of the things I was going to say is we know at the moment lots of owners are kind of hunkering down on their boats. They're maybe getting their jet to the marina where their boat is, and then they're sort of anchoring with their family and friends and not getting off the boat. Is that a good idea security-wise? Is that a bit of a nightmare because you're not moving around, so you're more easily identifiable?
That's true, you are. But if I had the option, I'd go that's exactly where I'd go and isolate. But no, you know, this is based on individuals' risks as well, that, you know, that the threats to individuals. You know, if somebody is higher risk and they go and sit in a certain location for a long amount of time, you know, it makes it easier for adversaries to pinpoint an attack. You know, security teams will be aware of this, and you know, you'll escalate to cover this.
So what kind of, when you say you'll escalate, if I'm an owner and I say, yeah, I've not really got any security, but I'm going to go and stay on my boat in such and such, what are the things that you say, okay, for God's sake, make sure that you don't do this, or make sure you take someone with you, or what's the kind of, I've got no security right now, do I need to get any, I guess?
Yeah, if they warrant security, then, you know, they'll probably know about it at that stage. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in terms of escalation, that starts at the very beginning, starts at the planning, you know, where they're going, what they're doing, you know, just thinking outside the box. You know, certain clients who fly into Mexico, if they're going to be in a certain location, we will advise them not to go on their own personal private jet, maybe transfer to a smaller jet. You know, this is onshore, but, you know, cartels will watch for private jets flying in. They'll want to know. They watch the airspace. They watch everything.
Really?
You know, same as organized syndicates at sea. And like yachts, aircraft are trackable. Mm-hmm. So you can see where they go. You can see it. It's all the pieces together. Communications as well. You know, this all starts at the very, very front. You know, securities, it's all good. Having a team on board, but there's so much more that needs to go into planning your own security environment before this, you know, and to do so, really, you need to understand the motive of an attacker. Now, the motive will be based on you. So, you know, how do you gauge that? How do you build a security environment around somebody without knowing the motive or the type of threat that faces them? So, yeah, so certain clients, many clients that we deal with, they start with a security assessment on themselves, a full risk assessment of themselves, their properties, mm-hmm. their boats, their families, their digital footprint, their social footprint, everything. And that helps us to determine the motive of a threat, and then in turn helps us to put management measures in place, or measures to manage and mitigate the risk.
And sort of talking about the explore angle a bit, so that sounds like that's a kind of standard thing that all yacht owners should be doing. But if you're kind of, you have a great plan to go and do, I don't know, Alaska or Antarctica or something, then obviously you need to kind of change your plan a bit. You spoke, when we spoke before, you sort of touched on the importance of getting local guides involved, especially if you're doing these kind of big exploratory trips. Why is that so important? And do you think enough people do it at the moment?
Local guides are, you know, from an exploratory standpoint, is, you know, it's essential. And, you know, it's actually raised a good point, Charlotte, because vessel owners, captains, you know, they won't hesitate to find local guides. Right? They won't hesitate to find local guides to help them find wildlife or to understand the dangers of the environment. It's just more important, if you like, you know, especially in ice regions or or anywhere actually. You know, for example, we did a nice trip in Papua New Guinea. Mm-hmm. So for me, by the time the clients come ashore, they've got tribes with spears and huge masks, you know, with caves full of skulls, where fires go in, and it's like a big play, you know, and it's great, and it's all fantastic. But when I'm there, I'm like, they're real skulls. They're real spears. You know, you know, it's important for us to have a local perspective on this, you know, what's right, not what's not. And understanding the atmospherics is absolutely essential to us. You know, we work with a lot of local people. We've built up a great, great network globally, people we trust. And I think it's absolutely essential. You know, if somebody from Papua New Guinea comes to the UK on a Saturday and, you know, we're in a bar and the football's playing, they might find that intimidating. Whereas mm-hmm. we'll just be like, oh, no, it's all right. It's just a game. It's normal Saturday routine. And they're like, oh, okay, great. We'll have another drink. It's similar, you know, it's the same thing, but, you know, on a greater scale, and having somebody that knows when things aren't right, something doesn't fit into place, you know, that's essential to me.
Are there any areas where you think that's particularly important? Like where do you think, you know what, you cannot go there full stop without getting local people involved?
Well, if you don't mind, I'll go back ashore on that for a great example of this. We recently completed two huge projects in Egypt. And one I could talk about is the Red Hot Chili Peppers. They did a gig in front of the pyramids. Mm-hmm. They had their own stage built right in front of the pyramids. I've quite often come away from countries thinking, I could have done without those guys. We probably could have managed well. But Egypt, there was absolutely no way I could have done without our local support. And we've built a great bond and a great partnership now. And you know, we're fully embedded in Egypt, because understanding the dynamics of a police state, working with a totally different approach. So, you know, everything's secret, even though we're working with them. We did a similar trip in Morocco the year before, went to meet with the chief of police, went to meet with the embassy, and it was all open. Everything, the support that they were going to give us, yeah, we're going to give you this, we're going to give you the gendarme for when you go outside of the city, the Medina police will work. You know, we knew everything. Whereas Egypt, I went to meet with the Ministry of Interior and the head of the tourist police, and he gave me Turkish coffee, and he says, everything will be okay, Pete. I had to take what I could from this, but what I learned is his word was everything. And actually, so much support turned up, I had to start managing, like putting them out of sight and trying to hide them. We had every man and his camel. Actually, we had police on their camels, and we had to sort of ask them to start going out of sight, otherwise they're going to alarm people and the band.
Steal the show.
But the moral of what I'm saying is, no, I think if you can have local support, seek it. You know, a great source of this for us is embassies. You know, it's a starting point. My background in the military was working with these embassies, carrying out close protection globally. So, you know, we know where to start with that. I have a great success with the US embassy. More so with the British, I shouldn't say that. But, you know, they're so helpful. And they're fully embedded in countries, and they have preferred suppliers who they will turn to and will vet and will put through our process. But then they come under our operations banner so that they work to our level of expertise and, you know, and to our level of operations, which the client is used to. And they love it, you know, and we all learn and we work together.
So you're planning your big adventure. Step number one is to get your security people, get your captain, get whoever's involved at the planning stages to reach out to kind of local people along the route, find out what the atmosphere is, and find out what's normal and what's not. What else can you do in the planning stage? Because I think you sort of touched on data as something that's quite important.
I think some of what you've just touched on is a process. Everything that we do is intelligence led. So we start with a thorough risk assessment, and it's based on intelligence, in country intelligence. So we have analysts that are experts at this. We have a platform that we use where we have, I think, nearly up to 80 analysts globally now. They feed live intelligence into the platform. It gives us a good feel for the type of threats that are in place. We can literally geofence a location, look at the icons, see what types of threats, see if that's going to affect us, and delve deeper into specific threat areas, if you like, and assess how that's going to affect us, and if it's going to affect us, and then we can mitigate on a more specific basis. But everything is intelligence-led, so we'll look into the country risk that can involve crime, that can involve natural hazards, which we see more and more now, particularly, and we're going to. And without digressing, natural hazards, we should come back to as a particular risk that that explorers should certainly face.
Yeah.
With global warming now, that more and more natural hazards, you know, ice breaking.
Let's talk about that now. Is that something that you've actually seen firsthand is becoming more of an issue in certain parts of the world? Or is it more that we're just going to places we haven't really been before?
No, I think we've all seen it in the last couple of years. You know, if we look at everything that's going on, even in the States, the fires, fires, tsunamis, volcanoes, everything, you know, you should gauge, we should always look at natural hazards. Everybody looks at crime when they're doing a risk assessment, but, so many more factors, medical, natural hazards, anything that's going to affect you. And it doesn't necessarily stop you from operating, but it does give you a what if.
That's such a good point, because I think of security and I just think of crime. I think of people trying to hijack the boat and pirates and people asking for bribes. You don't think about sort of what's going on in the natural world or, you know, bears approaching the boat or whatever it is. Yeah. You know?
Great point. You know,
maybe not bears. I don't know how close they get. I've not been on one, but you know what I mean. It's not something anyway, when you're envisaging threats, you tend to think of the natural wildlife as something that's kind of beautiful and amazing and it's going to be the highlight of your trip, you know?
Yeah. Bear, it's a good point. I had a slide for bears.
People just have to envision in their head.
Yeah. Trying to get, but what if? Right, and this is what we do. We think of what if, right? And we come up with some crazy things, but they can happen, right? They can happen.
And then what are some of the crazier things that you've been like, my God, no one could have seen that coming, but that was actually really, you know, hairy.
Oh, I know you've put me on the spot. Well, we did end up as fugitives in one country.
Oh, my God.
Due to a whole situation. And then while we were there, the township, in fact, it's Papua New Guinea. You know, it's such an unpredictable country. Then townships started rioting while we were fugitives in a hotel. And, you know, but that's not really crazy. It's just kind of nuts.
What are the things then, talking about threats, you know, some are more serious than others. What do you think owners tend to underestimate? So maybe natural hazards is one, but are there other things where you think, you know, you're worrying about, I don't know, getting mugged when you leave the boat, but really you should be thinking about how insecure your Wi-Fi kettle is, or, you know, these kind of things that we talk about.
Yeah. Well, let's have a look at that, actually, Charlotte, right? Rather than think of everything externally, how safe are you yourselves, right? So I did a recent interview. We were talking a lot about the insider threat, right? So we're talking about everything on the outside there. We're talking about risks, hazards, threats. But how well do you know everyone around you? How safe are you?
As in kind of crew and people joining you on the boat.
So I touched on this recently, and actually it's been a growing concern for me, because I know there's a huge, huge lack of due diligence in the maritime industry for checking who your crew are and their backgrounds. Now, if you're going further afield,
do you think that's pretty common, that people hire people based on word of mouth from their previous captain, their previous stew, and they don't really do the background checks? Yeah.
Here's a great stat for you. But how do you know, firstly, they are who they say they are? I think it was something like 40% of, during a survey, 40% of workers in London were working on false passports. Now, so passport checks, so validations of passports into various levels of due diligence. So, you know, if it's a basic, and again, on the yacht, you can tier this so that it's not a massive expense every time you hire someone. But if you've on your vessel, if you've created zones for trusted crew members, senior crew, I mean, does everybody have access to the owner's cabin and to his study?
Right.
You know, you can tier this, so you can have a basic background check done on your on your crew, on your new crew, more enhanced as they go further on. But we could do deep dives, you know, we could dive right into somebody and you know, social media profile is a big one, you know, social footprint, mm-hmm. how much do they talk about, what do they talk about, are there any motives or intent? But you really should understand the individuals around you,
yeah.
Particularly on an exploratory vessel when you're right out in the middle of nowhere. You know, is anybody potentially mentally unstable? Are there any warning signs? What do you do about that? Mental health's a key thing, right? What do you do?
And have you had instances where you've said to clients, you know, this person that works on your boat, I think you should consider not taking them with you to X, Y, and Z? Or is it just you have?
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
We've taken crew members off vessels.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go any deeper into that, but we have we've identified risks.
Talking about the boat and kind of security, because it's so interesting. Again, you think of threats and you think of external rather than what might be already on your boat that could be a problem later down the line. Obviously, with Corona and stuff, you know, we're talking to people a lot about sort of medical yachts and having isolation rooms on board. Or what kind of measures would you take on board as an owner now? If I'm about to go on a big adventure, I wanted to anyway. I don't think anyone on board has COVID. What should I be kind of doing as my backup plan? Do you need a hospital cabin? Is that unnecessary?
Well, how do you know everybody's not got COVID, firstly? So everybody needs to be tested. And then a vessel, it's an isolated vessel, but it's only as sterile as the last visitor or the last delivery. How are you controlling those? We've started recommending a great product. It's called E-Mist, and it's an electrostatic disinfectant sprayer. Which instantly it creates electrostatic in the disinfectant, so it clings to everything, but it immediately kills virus. Great for deliveries. You know, they're going on aircraft and all sorts now, and there's no touch. So you're spraying things down, you're spraying areas down in no time. You've got to consider that. It is a sterile place, but only as sterile as the last person or delivery.
Mm-hmm.
But again, keep touching on it, Charlotte, is escalation process. What if somebody does? And then what's the worst case? Go back to Egypt, and not the same trip, a different trip with a couple of clients and 60 guests. They hired the Abiroi Nile cruiser, 60 mm-hmm. guests on board, and we had an outbreak of Deli Belly, but it was quite serious, and it was... One got it, next day four, next day more. And we were like, right, we've got to isolate this immediately. So the whole boat mm-hmm. had stringent measures in place. The cleaning measures went up. You know, but again, it's an escalation. And I think nowadays what this virus has taught us is, you know, it's brought in a lot of products that we can detect and prevent viruses from spreading. And, you know, it should become common practice now. But yeah, you've definitely got to consider your escalation process and also the country that you're in. What mm-hmm. is there? You know, they're just going to keep you all on that boat. You know, there's a lot
of the kind of local rules and hospitals and facilities.
Yeah,
there, I guess.
Yeah. What do they do? And you should find that out before you go there. You know, what is your policy on COVID? What if somebody on board our vessel is detected with the virus? Even though you're quarantining them, they still see that vessel as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if they come ashore, you're bringing the virus ashore. So, you know, that you have to prove that that vessel's locked down. You have to prove that the virus has been contained. You certainly seek advice on that. You know, part of our medical risk assessment would be to include COVID measures now. I don't do that myself. We use a clinical director to help with this and give us the best practice for wherever we go.
So, you know, things like COVID are obviously threats that are in the forefront of our mind. Are some of the things I think of when I think of yacht security, like, you know, pirates and, you know, people holding you hostage on your boat, are there certain areas where maybe people don't go because they associate it with crime and actually you'd say, no, nope, fine to go there now? Or other areas where people think, you know, oh, it's safe there, and you'd say, well, actually, from the intelligence we've gathered recently, that's a bit of a dodgy one, maybe look at it more closely?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, this is an important thing as well, is identifying somebody's risk threshold. Now, you'll get some people, and you know, this will go up the count a lot with vessels with regular owners and not for charter. They'll be able to gauge the risk threshold of their owner, and where one person might go, another might not. They might feel uncomfortable. Yeah. You know, everybody's different. So, you know, you remember jumping off that top board when you were little, off the top diving board, right? Somebody would go flying past you, jumping off, and you'd be like stood there with your toes over the edge for ages before you went back down the ladder. You know, it's kind of similar. You know, everybody grows up with a different risk threshold, and also you've got to gauge that from the family. So from a charter perspective, I would say that that's really important.
Yeah.
Because if somebody is worried, if somebody does have concerns, or somebody in the group does, you know, it's an important question to ask. Is everybody experienced travelers? Is everybody feeling comfortable with this? If not, you know, we can aim to increase measures to enhance their comfort levels, you know, and make them feel more secure. I do have an analogy in the security industry, but it shouldn't apply to super yachts, actually, that you can pretty much travel anywhere in the world as long as you manage to risk correctly.
Yeah.
But that's if it's necessary. You know, I think we do that when exploring emerging markets for investment opportunities. Now, is that really necessary with a super yacht to go and visit these places? You know, the coasts of Mexico were fantastic. You know, they've been uninterrupted. It's great. But, you know, cartel threat is now spilling out onto the sea.
Really?
Particularly with the oil facilities now. They've switched. They've opened them up to international work. So, you know, we spent 3 months in the water of Sea of Cortez, and it was incredible, absolutely incredible. But, you know, I wouldn't go back there again without local support. I would 100% go there. But without that local support and intelligence and monitoring of that region, and people have got their ears to the ground, they still want the tourism. So there's, you know, I know we read about all the baddies, right? But there's more people that want right for their country and want good. So keep an eye on it. As long as you tap into those people and keep that level of intelligence ashore, then you know.
And where would you say, of all the places you've been, I'm a super yacht owner, I've mostly just gone to the Med and the Caribbean on my boat, I want to go somewhere with my family that feels a bit different and feels a bit adventurous, but I don't want to spend a huge amount on security, go somewhere that's really going to endanger us. I just want a bit of adventure that's a bit, you know, a bit of a departure from what I've done so far, but isn't going to be, you know, a really serious trip to consider going on. What's some good kind of almost entry level adventures that people of all different levels can?
Well, I'd head straight to Galapagos if I had a yacht, or you know, Antarctica, all these regions. Now, don't forget, what we talk about security, but you know, whenever I talk about us, you know, we're not security, we're safety and security. Security is safety. So, you know, a lot of what we do isn't just about, you know, baddies attacking the vessels. It's about, again, carrying out thorough risk assessments based on the regions you're visiting. So if you are going to Antarctica, you know, what is the ice situation like? You know, sort of seeking local advice. Now, we use our guys that are trained at mountain, jungle and Arctic warfare. But to do all that training, these instructors, you have to you carry out survival training. You carry out this to a very high level. So some of the mountain leaders we use, they run the carders. They're extremely knowledgeable. So you've kind of got guides doubling up as security as well on board vessels. But in terms of that's where I'd head, I think. But you know, then there's the, you know, for the more adventurous, definitely, you know, look around Papua New Guinea, sort of untouched region. I know there was a large vessel in Venezuela recently heading up to the falls, quite an incredible sight. And we've also done the Amazon, which was something else, you know. And again, we'll mitigate, we'll provide the correct measures, but it's good adventure. You know, some people, if they do have a slightly higher risk threshold, then go and visit these places. And you know, if they do fancy Brazil, give us a call because we have some great support down there. And, you know, we bring guys from the SWAT teams. You know, they're ashore and on the vessel armed. You know, they're fine.
Sounds very secure. Well, last question then, I'll let you get off. Just because I always kind of love hearing these stories and thinking, oh, my God,
I love it.
What are some amazing things that you've heard that you've thought, my God, you know, what a lucky escape those guys had, or that was an awful situation. Hopefully that would never have happened if we were involved. You know, what's the worst that you've heard of actually happening with super yachts?
Well, the thing with super yachts is you don't hear a lot about what's happening. I mean, people keep that very, very much under wraps. But, one incident always springs to mind, and I always bring it up, was an armed robbery on board a super yacht in the Mediterranean quite some time ago. Mm-hmm. But everybody at dinner, teams of, you know, it's completely organized. It was Eastern European gang, armed gang, all come on board. There's money in the safe. Again, going back to the insider threat, it was quite obvious that they knew the money was in the safe.
Yeah.
And robbed everyone at dinner. It was an easy target. You know, they're all at dinner on the deck. There's no security. There's no deterrent. So, you know, in security, we deter, detect, delay, respond. You know, deterrence is absolutely key.
Mm-hmm.
Criminals look for easy targets. They look for vulnerable targets. They'll start with a basic... For example, we did a cyber risk assessment down or a cyber analysis down in Monaco last year. We identified, well, I think 17 out of 600 yachts were secure, but we identified the easy ones through that. Now, if for us, from an attacker's perspective, if they were that vulnerable with their cyber and it was basic, you know, these were basics that anybody should be buttoning up. You wouldn't do that at home. Mm-hmm. So if they're that vulnerable on the yacht, they're an easy target. You know, that or at least gives us a smaller group to look at and, you know, delve deeper into what is an easy target. But piracy, armed robbery. But you know, armed robbery, if you think of that from the guest's perspective, from the owner's perspective, from the captain's, you know, you've got an armed team coming on board with weapons, pointing in everyone's faces at dinner, taking all their valuable jewellery. Watches, you know, and leaving a really distraught group of people for the rest of their lives.
Scary stuff, but it sounds like a good summary then. Everyone should have security anyway. If you're going somewhere, use local data, use lots of local guides. And the key thing that I'm going to take away from this is make sure you know who's actually on your boat and how well you actually know them, because it's a scary mm-hmm. thought. But probably
it
worth
is.
Looking into.
I think one key point I'd bring up here is you're right with data. So a lot of people think about security with their hearts. Now, that same person might run an extremely large organization that would never dream of making an investment without data and facts, without all the data and facts, right? And they'll shout at their team if they don't get all that right. So, you know, we come across a lot of people that say, oh, it's all right over there. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But that's based on their analysis of what they've just seen or heard or mm-hmm. whatever. But, you know, back everything up with facts and data. And that's what professionals would do with a risk analysis or what you should do. There are platforms out there that captains can, you know, utilize to do this in-house if they want to. You know, back it up and look at the facts before you make a decision.
Very good advice. Thank you very much, Pete. It's been lovely chatting, and hopefully we'll all be planning an adventure to the Galapagos soon and we'll be in touch.
Yeah, definitely bring me with you if you worry.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much, Pete.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Happy Thanksgiving to all of our US listeners, and we'll see you next week.